I'm really pleased to welcome today Dr. Sarah Marie Hall from the Department of Geography at the University of Manchester. Sarah is a reader in human geography and has done extensive work, particularly with ethnographies of austerity in Greater Manchester. And without further ado, let me hand over to Sarah. So thank you.
Hi, everybody. It's nice to sort of meet you. Thanks so much as well to Stephanie and to Chris and to the Breadline team for inviting me and for all your efforts in responding to the pandemic and rearranging this event. In spite of the ongoing situation, in that spirit, I hope today finds everybody as well as they can be. So you've done a really great job of setting the scene for me in terms of what austerity is and how it manifests in everyday life. So rather than go over all that again, I'll just dive straight in. So austerity policies and austere socioeconomic conditions across the UK, but also in Ireland and parts of southern Europe, have had a significant impact on everyday life and the political and structural regimes that shape society and the economy. In particular, as you've said, kind of cuts to spending, public spending, in order to decrease the national deficit, have compounded and accentuated deep already existing inequalities, especially around gender, race, class, disability and intergenerationality. And this occurs at multiple scales, from family, household and community to sectors of the economy, welfare, community services, local government, in which marginalised groups are key recipients but also key providers. And as Amy Greer Murphy argues, austerity is characterised by both spatial and social unevenness. Austerity then remains a contentious and pertinent issue for us as activists, academics and practitioners. It shapes the work we do as more than just a backdrop. It impacts how our work is funded and supported, the groups and the people we work with, and our own family and friends. And this ongoing relevance, or rather what I'll call the legacies of austerity, have also been highlighted by the recent COVID-19 pandemic. The slowing and effective stopping of many parts of the economy have created the conditions for a predicted economic recession in the UK and ongoing austerity measures, or rather the excuse for them. And then simultaneously, the ability of health and social care services to adequately respond to the pandemic has been hindered by a decade of austerity cuts, as well as leaving significant numbers of people living in poverty and then more vulnerable to contracting the virus due to ill health, substandard housing, low-paid employment opportunities, with Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups disproportionately represented. Emerging reports also point to the gendered nature of the everyday impacts of the pandemic, including concerns around inequalities in care responsibilities, higher likelihood of exposure to COVID-19 and increases in reports of domestic violence. And so I'd like to draw attention to the work of the Women's Budget Group, including their regular COVID briefings and the Crises Collide report. This work on the current and the previous impacts of austerity is necessary and significant, not only to document, but also to push back against these discriminatory and destructive policies. So as I've already mentioned, austerity is characterised by its compounding effects as felt in everyday life. Austerity policies and impacts are layered and simultaneous. People are hit on multiple fronts at the same time and at different times. It's become increasingly commonplace to be concurrently dealing with job losses, housing insecurity, welfare cuts, indebtedness and so on altogether. Austerity is also a prolonged and a violent condition. It cuts in the most intimate of ways on relationships, on identities, on embodied experiences, on mental and physical health, as well as systemic violences by discrimination, exclusion, gaslighting. Austerity is also temporally and relationally varied, so it can be omnipresent and close. It can ebb and flow into everyday lives, and it is and often feels unending. Austerity measures, after all, despite what we're often told, have not been reversed, and nor are key areas of the public sector been invested in at necessary levels. The focus of most of my work on this area to date has been on everyday life and relations, often through a longer term ethnographic and participatory engagement. And it's that that's led me to think about the legacies of austerity. And this is as much about thinking about future lives as about the legacies that austerity has already left and continues to leave, how austerity policies play out over lives and over time. So ongoing and updated reports from a range of international organisations, including Eurostat, the European Commission and Eurofound, have been tracing the impact of austerity at national scales, and usually according to demographic and to economic trends. And these are revealing, and listeners will be likely well versed in this. So for instance, following the global financial crisis of 2008-2010, and in countries where austerity policies have been vigorously imposed, there's been an accelerated drop in birth rates, which is also often referred to as stratified reproduction. Unemployment rates are increasing. Currently, youth unemployment across Europe stands at 16%, which is then muddied by 0 hours and precarious employment figures. There's unprecedented numbers of young people living at home, now stands at 3/4 of young people as an average across Europe. Rising personal debt, and with wages and rents mismatched with inflation. And austerity, of course, already has a legacy, the legacies that are all around us. Social and material infrastructures that have been slowly and painfully decimated. The life courses of those at the sharpest end, living in and through these changes. And the generations born, or perhaps never to be born, as a result of everyday austerity. The notion of legacy, after all, has its etymological roots in inheritance, of gifting or passing through generations. Moreover, these and other austerity impacts have deep and lasting social consequences that will outlast the policies themselves. And so with the rest of this talk, I want to think about what these legacies might be, and how we might go about understanding them a little bit better. So it's here that in asking these big questions about how to live together, how to survive together, and perhaps also how to thrive together, that I turn to social reproduction theory. So social reproduction, as many of us will know, consists of three interrelated components. There's biological reproduction, daily reproduction needs, and the reproduction of generations, or the labouring population. This is what Catherine Mitchell and colleagues call life's work. It requires understanding production and reproduction in tandem, and that to separate the two is to construct an undialectical artifice. So what draws me to social reproduction with this and often in some of my work is a way to think through legacies of austerity as having a multi-scalar approach, from embodied everyday practices of caring and reproducing to the structuring of society and its futurity. Austerity and social reproduction are also highly interrelated in theory and in practice. And this is because the most pervasive direct impacts of austerity are in the sphere of reproduction. So as Ruth Pearson and Diane Elson explain, this is in via cuts to social security benefits, cuts to expenditure on public services, and changes in direct and indirect taxes. These impacts on social reproduction are one of the reasons for which women, people of colour and working classes are left most vulnerable to austerity policies and measures. And in addition, austerity across these areas of social reproduction has been felt not only as a series of very targeted cutbacks, but in a continued and a historical lack of investment and value. So taking from social reproduction theory and thinking about the wounds that are left by austerity, with the rest of this talk I'd like to highlight three ways that I've started thinking and we might start to think through these legacies. And these are social infrastructures, life course biographies, and family futures and reproductive rights. So the term social infrastructure is increasingly being discussed in policy reports, in public fora, and in academic literature. We might even go so far as to say that it's the latest buzzword. It's a term that usually refers to the underlying structures that sustain social life, in an analogy with physical forms of infrastructure, like transport, energy or water. In the UK context, this popularisation of the term social infrastructures has perhaps unsurprisingly coincided with a decade of cuts to public services, which have then simultaneously undermined these very same social structures. So social infrastructure is commonly thought to refer to social spaces and spaces of sociability, like community centres, parks, libraries, places of worship, analogous with community services and third space. So Eric Klinenberg's Palaces for the People is perhaps one of the most well-known texts on social infrastructures. And his take is that social infrastructures are, and I quote, the physical places and organisations that shape the way people interact. To describe community services as spaces of social infrastructure is a means of acknowledging their importance and their value, a way to highlight the devastating impact of disinvestment and neglect on austerity hit communities and regions. So the intention there, it could be argued, is to locate communities within a more macro frame of infrastructures as a way to emphasise their importance. However, for me, the effect, intentional or otherwise, is to equate the sustaining of community with projects of physical material production, with many of the masculinist assumptions that go along with that. When we think about austerity and physical infrastructure projects, we do often think of our friend George Osborne, who's already been mentioned before, with his hat on, pointing to tall buildings, tall shiny buildings that are being built. So kind of equating this sustaining of communities to that physical material production then mobilises the idea of communities in support of physical infrastructure rebuilding as some kind of remedy for deindustrialisation. And to equate social infrastructure with community spaces and the activities that are in them, for me, is very reductive. It disregards the gendered labour, the processes of social reproduction that constitute and maintain these spaces and these relationships. And then it serves to compound their invisibility and their unacknowledged position. So with this, in some of my recent work, I've argued that social reproduction is infrastructure in and of itself. It's an infrastructure upon which to build societies and economies, a complex network of people, practices, politics, labour, love and life. It does the work of maintaining and sustaining life worlds. That said, material infrastructure is also important, and years of austerity have seen the dilapidation of the material fabric of many communities. Sure start centres, heritage sites, places of worship, local industries, including how they're funded and if they're maintained. Work on austerity urbanism, inspired by research in the US, has argued that the city is a significant scale at which to examine the economic, political and social implications of austerity, precisely, I think, because of this confluence of material and social infrastructure. But of course, austerity, in being socially and spatially mediated, it isn't confined to urban spaces alone. It bleeds into policies and practices that shape outer city areas, suburban and rural areas too. In a recent project on the everyday life and future of Brexit, I spent over a year doing ethnographic participatory work in one ward in Greater Manchester, during which time the local council closed the only community-run youth centre in the whole borough, which a local community partnership then reopened at a different site. The LCP furnished, decorated and repaired this new location, running it for over a year, operating lunch groups, childcare groups and offering it as a free space in the community, only for it then to be returned to the landlord, which was a local academy school. It now stands as it has done for the last 6 months. Its shutters are down and locked. The padlock on the gate is rusted from underuse, and litter and leaves decorate the perimeter. So when we think about legacies, I wonder what infrastructural ruins are left behind by austerity, material and immaterial. Who picks up the pieces, and will they fit back together if they ever did? is this knowledge paid? Sorry, is this labour paid, acknowledged, and valued? What policies will be developed to reinvest in social infrastructures, and will they recognise it as social infrastructure? What will our urban and rural landscapes look like? What remains when austerity has ravaged the things, people and places we hold dear? And these are, I think, entirely realistic questions to be asking, a delicate balance of acknowledging pain and damage, but also holding on to possibility and hopefulness too. So the legacies left by and in life course biographies is another theme that emerges out of a social reproduction approach, particularly if we think about the social reproduction as the reproduction of society and generations. The impact of austerity on life courses has started to attract growing interest across the social sciences, especially as it relates to young people growing up in a period of prolonged economic crisis. It can be argued that younger generations in particular have experienced large-scale political and economic change during their formative adult years. As I've already indicated, this might include living with or moving back home with parents or into precarious housing, struggling to find work or having to travel away from family and friends to secure employment, and altered possibilities for intimate and family relations and compositions. So on this topic, a few years back, The Guardian newspaper ran a photo series where young adult readers who had recently moved back home were asked to send in annotated pictures. And there's one that you see here, and there's a hyperlink on the slides that you'll also have a copy of. And they all kind of tell very neat stories, offering a window into young people's lives. These factors are relational, and I've said before that they overlap to mean that individuals are impacted in multiple ways. Writing on the impact of indebtedness on job insecurity, Davies and Cartwright suggest that the ability of young people to transition to adulthood via traditional benchmarks, the good job, home ownership, pension, marriage, having children, is severely impeded by previous debt accrual and the instability of income from precarious employment. For Sander van Laanen, who I think has actually joined us today, austerity is shown to linger on in the provision of suitable and affordable housing. For some young adults in his study, conducted in Dublin and Cork, this also impacts on opportunities for the futures they envisage, on what could have been. These overlapping impacts are also shaped, if not compounded, by simultaneous divestments in state-sponsored public services, some of which I mentioned earlier, but it includes mental health provision, social care, childcare, and the increased responsibilisation of families for young people's accommodation and wellbeing as a result of welfare changes. There are also emerging concerns that individual risks are not shared evenly across the life course or between generations, not least because of the uneven rhythms of care and dependencies that shape the temporality of the human life course. And this ties into the notion of relational biographies, which has been adopted within sociological and geographical literatures to describe how biographies are fundamentally relational in that they're formed, rehearsed, and reshaped in the interactions with real and imagined others over time. Rather than life courses being discussed as individualised transitions or trajectories, this emerging body of work argues that they are in fact entwined with times, spaces and relationships, including the life courses of other people. Personal interdependencies, often marked by care, are one of the ways in which life courses become knotted together. As such, it's difficult to extract the different elements of social reproduction, the reproducing of society or the reproducing of the everyday, from one another. The life course legacies left by austerity are then multiple in scale. They relate to personal lives as they're lived, the alternative routes that might be taken, the dead ends and the new paths that might be reached, the lives not lived. They relate to generational changes, a focus here on young people, partly for brevity. But of course, life courses include the whole spectrum of experiences. Take, for instance, the WASPI women fighting for state pension equality, or those losing lifetime jobs with the closure of factories and steelworks, like those in Redcar, Sheffield and Rotherham. These are all matters that are really close to my heart. They have an impact on the people I know and love. And I say this as a way to illustrate austerity's legacies in relational biographies too. So too does austerity have a life course, how it lives in and through people, communities and generations. How do we ensure these legacies are documented, understood, resisted? How do we make sure they're not further deepened and that the life course of austerity policies is subject to scrutiny and challenge? So in that sense, austerity has a life course as well in itself. And then the final theme I wanted to discuss is that of future families and reproductive rights. And I should start by saying that I toyed about what to call this, and I decided to sit with this tension of the idea of family, that it can have distinct patriarchal heteronormative connotations, but at the same time, it's used in common parlance. It means something to many people. There's a growing body of work that identifies the impacts that austerity has had on the making and maintaining a family, and the impacts that cuts have had on single parents, elderly people, those living alone, and the LGBTQ community. Gavin Brown, for instance, has argued that the bedroom tax and the marriage tax allowance serve as an example of how heterosexual couple formation and living arrangements shape normative understandings and policies of what constitutes everyday family life. And Eleanor Wilkinson's work has shone light on the experiences of queer women and how procreational norms are intertwined with ideas of family futures. Furthermore, within critiques of austerity and social reproduction, greatest focus has been placed on daily and generational reproduction, and I've spoken about both of those already, but biological reproduction tends to be slightly lesser discussed. There's a small but growing body of work that's considered, for example, austerity cuts to IVF services in Denmark, the growth of transnational adoption, egg donation, surrogacy and the necessity of abortion access in Spain, right-wing UK policies that are hinged on the anxieties of biological reproduction of migrant mothers, and health sector cuts and a lack of access to family planning care for migrant women facing infertility in France. Otherwise, where reductions in birth rates as a result of austerity are discussed, they're typically evidenced by large-scale demographic trends. So linking back to the previous points about social infrastructure and life course biographies, there's also the matter of how austerity has shaped whether or not people can have children, the experience of not having children because of austerity cuts. I mentioned before the interconnectedness of austerity measures and declining birth rates, and these have been especially stark in the UK. And it's this issue that's formed the basis of my recent ISRF fellowship that emerged out of the Everyday Austerity Project. So I'll give an example. Laura, for instance, whose name I've changed for anonymity, spoke at length with me about this issue. So she lived with her partner and two small children in rented accommodation. Both her and her partner worked. They had a sizeable credit card debts to pay as well. She talked about how her debts shaped her financial and family prospects in terms of whether they might buy a house, what savings they have, if they have pensions, and whether they could have more children. Debt was omnipresent in their memories and their future imaginaries. She explained, and this is a quote, "We probably will be renting for a lot longer. We do want to buy, but we want to try and get out of debt, get a pension sorted, get married in December next year. Whether we'll have another baby or not, I don't know. But it's a possibility, I don't know." At the time of this conversation, I'd known Laura for over a year and I felt like I knew her quite well. But it was the first time that she'd ever mentioned having more children. It was a decision to be made. It was for future Laura to think about. But it was a direct result of the debts that she was currently trying to pay off, and it was because of these debts that she was particularly ambivalent. Obstacles in reproduction don't fit into neat discourses of infertility, non-reproduction or childlessness. They're situational. And similar to the previous discussion, These biographies are highly interrelational. They draw in other people, her partner, her children, but also her future self, of who she might be and who she might become. But these narratives were marked by absence and equivocation as much as by eventfulness. Lots of buts, maybes, possiblys, don't knows and nots. Here, debt presents as a conjuncture for Laura that was much about the possible as the impossible. What's also interesting here is the idea of not having children or as many children as might be wanted as a result of austerity sits at stark contrast with frankly classist and racist tropes about people on low incomes or supported by welfare as having big families. And as I've already noted, language around this topic is complex, where terms like infertility, child-free, childless, non-reproduction are ill-fitting, they're incomplete. On the latter of these, non-reproduction, Nina Power writes of how non-reproduction is more than a micro-personal decision. It needs to be understood in a broader collective context, and she contends that non-reproduction is difficult to engage in because social reproduction is continuous and it isn't just constrained to the biological. Instead, and taking from Angela Davis, social political challenges to reproduction, like austerity, can instead be framed more as reproductive rights. Myths of choice about biological reproduction still circulate within common discourse, and they also infiltrate into political and civic movements. To consider reproductive rights, then, is to acknowledge the political spaces in which this reproduction occurs, like austerity, and how reproductive rights, whether gestating, abortion, sterilisation, have to be understood together and in context. Reproductive rights, responsibility and relationships are endemic to everyday practices and politics, altering how austerity is lived in and with societal scale repercussions. For the demographic and generational composition of society has huge implications for economic structure, for human rights, for well-being, for migration, and for social infrastructure. What are the reproductive legacies of austerity when we consider decisions about having children, including by gestation, IVF, abortion, surrogacy, and across racial and class heritage? What about abortion, contraception and sterilisation? Are decisions about having children just being delayed, or are they being permanently defaulted? And my emerging findings show that actually it's the latter. How can we actively reframe heteronormative austerity policies and legacies undergirded by assumptions about who lives together and how they live together, whilst at the same time acknowledging desires for biological reproduction, the very literal meaning of a legacy? To close, and I think I'm just within time, I realise I've asked far more questions than I've answered, but this is because I don't have all the answers either. So considering the legacies of austerity, whether we might use social reproduction as the framework or, like I've suggested, or something else, is incredibly important given that austerity as policy, condition, politic, isn't going to be going away anytime soon. But to do so, we also need to rethink our methodological toolkits. And so in the spirit of this talk, I'm going to close with a question. How can our methodologies go beyond the present, beyond individual moments? How can we transcend the temporal fixity to think about how austerity's legacies are a messy recipe of past, present and future? Thank you.